Hello, everyone, and welcome to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Marcia DePaula, with Steptoe & Johnson, PLLC, in Western Pennsylvania. On the program, we span the globe with updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. Today, we're talking about student athletes, definitely a hot topic, whether it's name, image, likeness, or athletes as employees. Joining us on the program are Max Horer, partner at Miller Nash LLP in Portland, and Damian D. Giovanni, partner at Morgan Brown & Joy in Boston. So Max is a former Division I college football player and leads sports, entertainment, and media team at Miller Nash. Max provides advice to name, image, and likeness collectives, educational institutions, professional sports teams, agencies, management companies, amateur and professional athletes, and other sports and entertainment individuals and businesses. Damian specializes in management side labor and employment law with a particular focus on labor issues affecting colleges and universities. Damian regularly litigates cases before the National Labor Relations Board and federal courts around the country. Max and Damian, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marcia, for that warm welcome. I'm excited to be here. Max and I on different sides of the country, so we've got the entire place mapped out here. So we're excited to be with you today.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, I'm excited for this topic, especially knowing several student athletes who will be playing sports at colleges and universities this fall. So really some good timely topics here. Max, we have heard that there's been changes in NIL compensation for college athletes. How did we get to where we are today?
Great question. So I think it's important to go back in time to early 2021. Yes, we were still in the midst of COVID, but what was really happening around the country were states, specifically California, enacted California Pay-to-Play Act, which really prompted and said under California law that student athletes can make money off of their name, image, and likeness. And so that started the process there. And then Florida, soon thereafter, used that bill and crafted their own. But the effective date of the California bill, I think, was January 2023. And the Florida one was July 1st, 2021. And so from there, there was this move from all the states enacting laws that basically allowed their state institution and their student athletes to, you know, be able to make NIL deals while they're in the state. Now, that was against NCAA rules and bylaws. And so around this time in June also came the Alston decision. And I have to make mention, they are not the same kind of issues. Alston did not decide NIL. It was for capping education-related expenses for student-athletes. But the importance of it was really the Supreme Court making a decision about the NCAA's ability to govern, especially amateur sports. So in the Alston case, which is well-known, NCAA loses in convincing fashion 9-0 with very strong concurrences by some of our Supreme Court justices. And around that time, also in June, all these states, about 20 around the country, or governors enacting executive orders, started enacting these laws. And so right before July 1st, 2021, the NCAA enacted their interim NIL policy, which we are now in early 2024, has generally been in effect for this period of time. It's really been more of a long-term NIL policy. So the state laws really kind of prompted the beginning of this. The Alston decision helped also in terms of eroding some of the NCAA's authority. And that's really how we got to NIL compensation the way we know it today.
Well, in that vein, there's been a lot of speculation and discussion regarding a potential federal law. Do you think that's likely to happen?
My gut, if I'm Notre Dame, and I'm not, but maybe I am, I don't know. No, I don't think that's likely to happen, in part because there's just a lot of other issues besides name, image, and likeness compensation that is occurring. that is out there an issue. So for example, what we're seeing now with some of the state laws is there's more facilitation, I guess. Should schools be more involved in NIL compensation? Should there be a antitrust potential exemption to involved in a federal bill? Should there be a special classification for student athletes as employees or non-employees and how they should be treated? I mean, I think when the first couple bills came out, both the Senate and the House, everyone was really scrutinizing them closely, as they should. But I think we're at like 8, 9, 10 proposed bills. And, you know, a lot of this seems to be more political messaging with roundtables and getting former famous head coaches in the room and some media attention for their political campaigns. I just see right now some of the court, like if you were to do an NIL narrow bill, I think it has a good shot. But with the other issues also happening in college sports, I think it's a lot more difficult to come to an agreement that will pass both the House and the Senate in this Congress and be enacted into law and preempt all the state laws from an understanding of, yeah, that's the idea, is that we don't want this patchwork approach. But I think there's too many highly political issues and a disagreement on how to deal with them for this to actually happen.
So Damian, Max mentions that the student athlete employment debate really seems to be a big hurdle in the way of a federal bill. And definitely we don't know if it will be seriously considered by Congress due to that. But can you explain what has happened and what is currently happening with these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And to sort of follow with Max's theme here, we're going to go a little bit further back in time. And, you know, the National Labor Relations Board, which is a political body and not one to wait for the sort of processes of Congress to move forward, has sort of taken an active role on this issue. And just briefly, sort of the National Labor Relations Board, which is the administrative agency that administers the federal law, the National Labor Relations Act, has been around since 1935. So this is an agency that's sort of deeply rooted in private employment matters in the private sector. And just for everyone's sort of edification, it's a political body that the members of the board are appointed by the current president and then approved by the Senate. So as you might imagine, not to sort of use these as a four-letter word, but when I say things like the Trump board and the Biden board and the Obama board, it's just to sort of orient our listeners that when you've got a Democrat in the White House, you're going to likely have some more progressive left-leaning policies and frankly, decisions that come out of the board in Washington. And the issue of student athletes being considered employees under the National Labor Relations Act is really intertwined with the board's rulings on student employees in general. And for those that practice in this field, it's sort of, I don't want to say frustrating, but you're always on your toes. So for about 65 years under the National Labor Relations Act, students were not able to unionize because they weren't considered employees. And in 2000, that changed. There's a case with the New York University where the National Labor Relations Board said students could be employees. Once the Bush board got put in place 4 years later, in a case called Brown University, the board said they can't be employees because they're primarily students and the relationship they have with the colleges and university is primarily academic. So no longer do they have rights under the National Labor Relations Act. 12 years later, under the Obama board, this flipped again, and the National Labor Relations Board, same body, different group of people on the board, ruled that students could be employees. And so there's been a lot of flip-flopping on that, but the Columbia decision in 2016 remains good law. And in sort of briefly how that came to be was they use the common law employee test. And essentially, they make a determination regardless of whether you're a student or not. The employer has the right to direct and control the employee's work. The work is in service to the employer, and the work must be performed in exchange for compensation. Now, since Columbia, the vast majority of cases related to graduate student workers, so teaching assistants, research assistants, there's been cases with tour guides that provide the tours to students on campus, resident advisors, the folks that live at the end of the hallways in these dorms. But more recently, and what I'm going to sort of get to in a second, the board has sort of set its sights on college athletes. And just a little bit more history here. In 2015, prior to Columbia, the National Labor Relations Board was presented with a case with the Northwestern football players, and they had attempted to unionize. And the regional director, which is just below the appellate level at the board, said that they could be employees. They were employees. And the folks that were receiving scholarships were, in fact, employees because that satisfied the compensation prong. The football team was generating quite a bit of revenue. So there was service to the university. And theoretically, because they were directing sort of when practices were and what types of actions they would do during practice, that satisfied all three prongs. Now, that case made its way up to Washington. And despite it sort of being, you know, as I mentioned before, the Obama board, they punted on the issue of employee status. But in that case, they declined jurisdiction over the case itself and over this group of employees because it wouldn't promote, as they said, labor stability. And the concern from the National Labor Relations Board at the time, or at least what they took into account, was all other teams in the Big Ten were public institutions, which the National Labor Relations Board does not have jurisdiction over. And frankly, the vast majority of college football programs in the FBS, I think it was 108 out of 125, were public institutions. And what the board said was sort of labor issues directly involving only an individual team and its players would also affect the NCAA, the Big Ten, and the other member institutions. And many terms, sort of employment terms applied to one team, would likely have ramifications for the other team. In hindsight, an incredible sort of restraint by that board, they decided we're going to decline jurisdiction. We're not going to rule on the employee issue. And frankly, there's a concern if we take jurisdiction over one team in a single league. And that was really grounded in history, not necessarily in college athletics, but professional. And a lot of sort of professional soccer leagues and others where the board just didn't feel comfortable saying, you one team in a group of many are required to negotiate with your players, even though it's going to have some impact on the rest of the league. There's sort of a fundamental unfairness to it all. That was the only case we had heading into this past year dealing with college athletes. And despite being Northwestern still being good law, there was a case in Region 1 in Boston, where I'm from, where the regional director in Boston basically ignored that premise, among other employee issues, which we'll get to in a second, and determined that Dartmouth basketball players are not only employees, but it was appropriate for the board to assert jurisdiction over just that team, despite it being one of eight in the Ivy League. So that was sort of my long-winded answer to kind of prime you to sort of what's been going on. But that's kind of the backdrop of what we've been talking about and sort of where this is going in terms of the board's assertion of jurisdiction over these cases and whether college athletes and maybe beyond that are going to be considered employees moving forward.
Well, Damian, you're definitely playing a key role in the Dartmouth case. But more importantly, how are Dartmouth and the other Ivy League schools different than many of the Power Five schools that we're familiar with?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And historically, and again, it's essentially sort of not necessarily dicta, but the regional decision in Northwestern isn't precedent. But in that case, the regional director said, because these students get these very, very valuable scholarships, such, you know, the cost of college has gone way up since even 2015. But even back then, the sort of total package of a scholarship was worth $60,000-$70,000. And in that instance, the regional director said that satisfies this compensation prong. And in that case, they said it was contingent on them continuing to play football at Northwestern. And if they stopped, which was theoretically the work, they'd lose that money. And the thought process there was there's that compensation prong, the quid pro quo. You're performing a service for this employer. You get paid for it. That makes you a common law employee. The general counsel's office, who sort of sets policies for the regions, the National Labor Relations Board, they've issued two guidance memos. And their focus has been on students who receive scholarships in exchange for playing a sport. What's really different and unique about Dartmouth is that the Ivy League does not allow athletic scholarships. And in those instances, they're not putting aside whether they're employees or not, but they're not getting compensation in the traditional sense to play sports in the Ivy League. So that's one issue, that the scholarship piece of it isn't there. So there's no sort of money going that way in exchange for playing sports or whatever the activity might be. Beyond that, again, the regional decision in Northwestern focused largely on the profit and revenue generation of these sports. And they basically said they're benefiting quite a bit from this football program. The players are getting money for it. That's in service to the university. In Dartmouth, they're not generating profits. It's a net negative on revenues. And this isn't just unique to Dartmouth. This is probably 95, if not more, percent of the schools that run sports and athletics programs, where they're doing it because it benefits their students and they consider it part of a well-rounded education, and they're not generating money for the school. So there were sort of key differences in Dartmouth versus some of the Power Fives. A, again, they don't generate profits. They don't receive athletic scholarships, which was crucial in the Northwestern decision. And then a recent sort of decision, Dartmouth moved to stay the election while this issue played itself out in the review process. The National Labor Relations Board denied that request, but in dissent, member Kaplan sort of said, this would be the first time ever we've dealt with this where the players don't get scholarships. So that was sort of one of the key focuses on the compensation side. And then just a couple sort of points to fill that out. At Dartmouth, like many of the Ivy Leagues, they get need-based financial aid. So it has nothing to do with whether you play sports or not. If you know, like any other college student, if you need financial aid to sort of pay for college, they get it. And if they decide when they get there, they don't want to play basketball or any other sport, it does not affect the money they receive for financial aid. And a couple other points, you know, there are actually some students that didn't receive any financial aid. So imagine a situation where these students are actually paying their employer under the board's, the regional decision to be employees. So there's a lot of differences in that regard. And lastly, on this point, because that compensation piece just simply wasn't present there, the regional director in that case said, well, we've got to find something else from compensation. And what she did was sort of, in my opinion, stretched the bounds of what that means. And she said, well, shoes and sneakers that they use to perform, to play basketball is compensation. And early reads on whether they're entitled to financial aid when they're in high school, a benefit that goes away completely when they step on campus, is somehow considered compensation. And for the first time in 90 years of the National Labor Relations Act, we've got a regional decision that said the compensation prong is satisfied, even though they don't receive any monetary compensation. And this was really sort of a large ground shift here. Now, again, this is a regional decision. The decision is being appealed in Washington right now, but it's certainly a troubling aspect of this issue if this decision stands. And lastly, on this point, the Northwestern decision with regard to the sort of labor stability, while the Ivy Leagues are all private institutions, 40% of Dartmouth's games were against public institutions. Two-thirds of the Division I basketball programs in the country are public institutions. So the concern and the basis for the Northwestern decision was similarly present. And that was sort of largely ignored at this regional level. So there's sort of a lot going on here, and we're sort of in limbo right now until the board decides whether they're going to take this case up on review. But that's sort of in a nutshell kind of what was happening with Dartmouth and how they attached employee status to these college athletes.
That's definitely a shift. Max, in light of what Damian has just said, what do you think the state of NCAA is, and in turn, their member institutions?
Marcia, it is not great. I mean, the times of a couple years ago are gone, and we are, I can honestly say, living in the Wild West. So let me kind of set this up. There are the NIL rules, which are student athletes cannot enter into NIL deals that allow pay to play. For instance, I score a touchdown, I make money. These prohibitions are still required and under NCAA rules, and student athletes need to adhere to them. Second, there's no direct institutional payment for NIL from the college or their fund or anything else like that. Texas A&M tried to do that, and it got poo-pooed by the NCAA and others. So currently, schools cannot pay for NIL. Lastly, there has to be a quid pro quo requirement, and that is I have to actually do something for the money. I just can't get something for free, because that is still an impermissible benefit. And why I just went over the NIL rules is because when the NIL rules went into effect in July 1st, 2021, the rest of the NCAA bylaws and rules were still in effect, including no inducements to attend, the transfer rules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think a lot of people, once again, conflate everything into one big pot of issues. They're not, they're separate. And so currently the NCAA, since after the Alston case, as I said, really opened them up for lawsuits, has been sued a lot. I think they're like, we're at 13 antitrust cases and counting. A couple weeks ago, maybe there was two of them filed in a week. And it's almost like, you know, it used to be just huge news when the NCAA would get sued. And now it's like, just seems to be the second page of your local paper and how often it happens. But I'm going to highlight a couple of the key cases to track. And one of them, which has affected student athletes immediately in schools, is the state of Ohio versus the NCAA, which is the transfer eligibility rule case. And it basically says that the NCAA had a rule that didn't allow athletes to transfer more than twice, and they have to wait a year before competing in games with their new team if they did. Which is notable about this case, the attorneys general of Ohio, Colorado, Illinois, New York, North Carolina, Tennessee, West Virginia, Minnesota, Mississippi, Virginia, and District of Columbia, along with the Department of Justice, are against the NCAA in this case and have won, at least on the TROPI stage, allowing athletes now to freely transfer. And so currently you've seen now athletes jump from one school to the next without having to wait out a year. Notably, there was a recent athlete that left Alabama, went to Iowa, and then I think within 5 days left to go back to Alabama. So it has changed the way, I guess, college athletes have conducted themselves and how coaches and schools have had to deal with it. And I think this case really has shocked, I guess, the what was once, you know, athlete goes to your school, is there for 5 years, 4 years, that you get to know them, you see them develop. That has all changed in part because of this case and the rule itself being an antitrust violation, because it unjustifiably restrains the ability of these athletes to engage in the market for their labor if they're not allowed to do this. So then we transition to the class action damages cases, which is the House versus NCAA case and the Hubbard versus NCAA case. And the House case is seeking damages for athletes that played before NIL rules were enacted, like broadcast deals, game promotion, and school apparel contracts. The Hubbard case is seeking retroactive Alston-related payments dating back to 2018. And between these two cases, there's another two cases, the liability out there for the NCAA is about $4 billion, $3 billion, probably is going up every day in terms of the exposure. And so when you're talking about the issues the NCAA is facing, these class action damage lawsuits are really not just in the back of their mind, in the forefront of their mind, to in order to exist going forward. Because while the NCAA, you know, is a big organization and its member institutions are involved, we're talking about a lot of money here, and that would hurt any organization. And so then we transition to a different type of case, which is the Tennessee and Virginia versus NCAA case, where the attorneys general of Tennessee and Virginia sued the NCAA for their inducement rules, their NIL recruiting ban rules. And the judge in that case in the preliminary injunction phase said, yeah, I'm granting that these rules are an illegal agreement to restrain and suppress competition within the labor market of Division I athletes. And, you know, prospective student athletes, or high school student athletes and transfer athletes have a short window of making a commitment. And the way that the rules are set up, they can't actually confidently, you know, basically check out the market to understand what their potential NIL value is. And because of that, it has stifled the market, restrained the trade, and therefore this isn't allowed. And when that happened, I think that was February 23rd, the NCAA a week later came out with a letter basically saying, you know, the rules that this case has enjoined for the time being, and note this is temporary, a settlement could happen and the rules could go into effect in some type of manner. So it's really something that you just have to kind of watch, but you can't take as fact at this point because it is temporary. But what it really allows now is these collectives, these boosters and collectives, I really don't like the name, but I think at this point, you know, when you say collective, people generally know what you're talking about, and that's important. But they're effectively third-party marketing companies, can enter into now deals with high school student athletes, make the deal contingent upon them coming to a certain institution. And the inducement rules that everyone really knew about and relied upon in college sports is in some ways been eviscerated. So I think currently the NCAA has more cases than they can count on two hands, certainly maybe four hands, that are notable. And I've just highlighted just a couple. So I certainly not an exhaustive list, but there's certainly some issues. And last but not least, I'll mention that the NCAA has tried to evolve and they have proposed Project D1. I call it Subdivision Zero because it just makes sense in my head. but basically allowing schools to offer educational benefits and also invest a certain amount of money in athletes. And there are so many other considerations there in terms of Title IX implications and you know, how this will actually look and what does this mean for quote-unquote sports that make a profit and sports that don't. You can go on a debate far longer than this podcast has time for and that anyone wants to listen to, I guess. The point being is that there's so many of these things, and the NCAA has started to make movements to try to do that, to try to deal with that, but it's evolving quickly.
Wow, there's a lot for these colleges and universities to consider and to follow. So just thinking about that, Damian, going back to you, what does the future of college sports look like?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Marcia. And sort of, as I mentioned before, this back and forth, ironically, some of this depends potentially on what happens in November next year. From a labor perspective, I think there's some real concern out there, both from the sort of legal interpretation of the National Labor Relations Act, but also just the fallout of what happens, especially again, you know, if the decision in Dartmouth stands, which, you know, again, in my opinion, is on very, very shaky grounds and just the law kind of interpreted incorrectly. But there's concern about sort of what the impact's going to be. And it's sort of, if you look at it twofold, one is if the National Labor Relations Board sort of either denies Dartmouth's request for review or takes it up, essentially affirms the decision, the concern is going to be, where's the line drawn? So again, while not sort of specific and not kind of stamped with case law, there is at least some understanding that maybe the scholarship issue could at least draw some semblance of a line to work off of. That's gone with the decision from the regional level in Dartmouth. And if you look at it from the perspective of if shoes and benefits you get with regard to how much financial aid you could potentially get when you apply to college 2 years later meets the compensation prong, there really is no line. And now you're not only talking about potentially sort of the Power Five schools, but you're talking about Division I, Division II, Division III, high school teams. You know, we joked earlier, I think Max's athletic career sort of went a little further than mine. But, you know, in high school, we used to get sweatshirts and sweatpants. And that was part of being on a team and part of the sport. And, you know, that is considered compensation. The National Labor Relations Board sort of stretching beyond what I think the act allows to find employee status is really problematic. And then if you look at it from an impact perspective, you know, as I mentioned before, the large majority of schools, whether they're Division I or on down, are not turning a profit and not generating revenue with their sports programs. They run them because I think it sort of is an important part of the academic experience for a lot of students in colleges and universities, but it's not a moneymaker. And the issue is, if student athletes who really are not employees are granted rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And what that means is if they vote to unionize, the employer is obligated to sit down and negotiate terms and conditions of employment with them, with a group of, again, I'm using air quotes, I know you can't see them, employees in a situation where they're not generating any money. It's going to be even costlier than it is now. And what I think you might start to see is a lot of these schools saying, well, it's too expensive to maintain a lot of these sports. I think it's going to be a really unfortunate result of this type of decision. And as Max sort of mentioned earlier, there's sort of Title IX consequences to that. And schools may be picking and choosing which teams they want to keep. And that obviously has an impact on, you know, women's sports and whether there's going to be an equal amount and who's going to continue to kind of, again, really participate in an extracurricular activity that's been an important part of colleges and universities, but not from an employee-employer perspective. So again, I'm hopeful that the board in Washington is going to sort of see this and sort of correctly determine that these folks are not employees, but time will tell on that. But as I mentioned, from a legal perspective, I think we're stretching beyond what the NLRA was meant to cover in terms of who are employees. But from a sort of practical impact standpoint, I think it's going to have wide-ranging negative effects. So as Max said, we're not prognosticators here, but that's potentially the kind of fallout, at least on the labor side.
Damian, I'll jump in on my thoughts here. I mean, it is wild. I feel like I'm on a roller coaster ride. And I'll say this, I think in the future, a new system has to be reimagined in some respects. What that looks like, Well, I'll let that for the pundits. Although I will say, and I'll quote one of my favorite musicals of all time, you know, the NCAA and these people want to be in the room where it happens and not let all the judges around the country basically dictate how these things are done. And Charlie Baker has said that in his letter recently. I'll say that people in higher education, which is what we're talking about, and student athletes, and I'm a former student athlete. My wife was a former Division I softball player as well. And it's such a important time in your life when you're transitioning from, you know, being in high school and living with your parents to out to college, playing a sport, being coached by people for the first, you know, first time away from your family in the highest level competition. I think these issues need to be dealt with sensitively with people that understand them deeply and appreciate the complexities and the importance of it. I certainly hope going forward in the future that like minds and the people that understand this industry the best come together with a thoughtful solution, not one that's rooted in too much of past history, but one that is rooted in understanding of what needs to be in the future, what makes sense for the collective body to continue to exist. At the end of the day, we're talking about student athletes, our youth. I was one of them when I had hair. So I think the point being is that these student athletes become contributing members of our society, and they should be given the tools and the opportunities to continue to grow and learn and evolve. And I certainly hope the new system handles some of these issues with care and sensitivity. But I will say this for the ELA podcast, lawyers will be involved in constructing this new system.
Well, that was great, Max and Damian. This has definitely been a fascinating discussion, and thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Marcia. This was great and happy to be on here with you and Max, one that I was looking forward to. So thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you, Marcia.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with Max or Damian, please click on their bios in the description of this podcast. We also encourage you to reach out to any of our lawyers around the world by selecting Find a Lawyer on the ELA website at ela.law. In addition, search the ELA website where you can sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers and on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Marcia DePaula from Steptoe & Johnson. Thanks so much for listening.